this country and using them as critical catalysts for that change, you're putting them in jail.
And Jahan, I'm just going to interrupt because we have 10 seconds. The Al Jazeera journalist Peter Gresty Mohammed Fahmy and Bahar Mohammed, still in jail. You did control room.
Still in jail, unjustly in jail, and join many other journalists and protesters.
And what's critical as both Egyptians and Americans right now, Egypt being the second largest recipient of U.S. aid, we need to, as active citizens, be aware of where our tax money is going.
We have to leave it there. Karim Amer, Jahan Najim, thank you so much. Yeah. Award-winning filmmakers of The Square. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltzer, Martin Nermin, Shakespeare, Martinez, Sam Malkoff, Hani Masood, Ravi Karan, Dina Gezder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Tuned into KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, Portland, 91.9 FM, Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 FM, Philomath and Corvallis. Up next, the KBOO Evening News.
Tune into KBOO Friday, January 30th at 8 p.m. for a 13-hour celebration of Alan Lomax on his 100th birthday.
Get on board, little children, and ride with me. This is Alan Lomax, your ballad man, inviting you for a ride on the folk song train, the train that runs wherever the people sing, wherever the people make their music.
KBOO hosts and special guests will be playing excerpts from Alan Lomax's long life of field recording. We'll play radio shows, field recordings, interviews, and more. That's the Alan Lomax Centennial Celebration with 13 hours of special programming, Friday, January 30th at 8 p.m. to Saturday, the 31st at 9 a.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Tune into KBOO every weekday at 7 p.m. for Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective with Davey D. Hard Knock Radio features in-depth interviews and profiles with community leaders, activists, hip-hop artists, and musicians, giving voice to community concerns and offering a unique forum to explore issues relevant to hip-hop community. That's every weekday at 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Multnomah County Sheriff reconsiders his plan to revoke all in-person visitation rights for prisoners in local facilities.
The Morrison Bridge will be closed for 3 weeks as inspectors look into cracks on the deck that was repaired just 3 years ago.
Israel launches airstrikes in Syria for the second time in a week as tension steps up throughout the region.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 28th, 2015. I'm Nico Kwiatkowski.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. The Multnomah County Corrections Division is reconsidering its plans to take away in-person visitation from people imprisoned in local jails and prisons. The sheriff's office announced that they will wait for 6 to 8 months to implement the new plan after an outpouring of criticism followed an expose in the Portland-based Street Roots newspaper. While the sheriff's office has said they will consider the public criticism, they did not agree to stop pursuing the plan to deny all visitation to all prisoners. In fact, the county has already signed a contract with a Texas company to do video conferencing instead of in-person visitation, a move that the ACLU of Oregon and other groups have criticized as a constitutional violation. KBOO's Joanna Peterson filed this report. It begins with local activist Joe Walsh speaking out about the issue at the recent meeting of the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners.
My name is Joe Walsh. I represent Individuals for Justice. I sent all of you an email yesterday concerning this topic. The topic is the county jails. We received an email the other day that says three things. In the county jail, all personal visitations will cease. They will be on video. So you will go to county jail to visit your loved one, and you will see them on a video, and then you will be charged for the privilege by a private corporation.
That was Joe Walsh with Individuals for Justice. He was speaking at a county meeting last week about the Multnomah County Jail System's decision to eliminate in-person visits. Since then, the Multnomah County Sheriff has agreed for the time being to allow some face-to-face visits. For more, I spoke with Public Information Officer Steve Alexander. I've heard a lot of complaints that limiting face-to-face interaction with inmates, you know, making visit only via video, they would call it cruel and unusual punishment, and they would say it's a direct violation of their inmate rights. So how would you respond to that? I'm sure you've heard these complaints.
As I said before, the sheriff is part of the process. He's in this and keep monitoring what's going on. So he's listening to the feedback he gets, whether it be from the public, from other county government, from whoever it is that wants to give us feedback. So we're listening to that, and this is part of that. But one of the things that we heavily weighed in this was the fact that the video visiting option expands what we could provide, because we can't provide visiting 7 days a week, 10 hours a day. We just don't have the staff, the manpower, the resources to be able to do that in a cost-effective way.
So is there any concern that with the video visitation that face-to-face visits will be kind of phased out eventually?
I think that's something that is part of the review process. The sheriff's been very active in listening to people and listening to the public and feedback that he's received from the public. So as we move through this, I think we're going to continue to look at it. We're continuing to look through this process, and the sheriff has set up some semi-annual reviews, and we'll designate some work group to get together and take a look at the processes as we go. We'll look at the positives. We'll look at the negatives.
I've been speaking with Public Information Officer Steve Alexander. We've been discussing the new video visitation system in the Multnomah County jails. For KBOO News, I'm Joanna Peterson.
Ongoing engineering problems with the Morrison Bridge have forced county crews to shut down eastbound lanes for the next 3 weeks. The closures allow crews to inspect the premature corrosion of the bridge's surface that was installed in 2012. This report was filed by me, Nico Kwiatkowski. For more than 2 years now, engineers at Multnomah County have been monitoring problems with the Morrison Bridge. The bridge's driving surface was replaced in 2012 when slippery steel panels were removed to make way for a supposedly cost-effective and safer material known as fiber-reinforced polymer, or FRP. Zelcomp, a North Carolina company that manufactures the panels, states on their website that FRP decks, quote, do not corrode. However, the county had become aware of significant corrosion mere months after the installation. And it wasn't until the Portland Mercury released a video they obtained through public records that the extent of the problems could be appreciated.
I didn't see if you wanted to drop that in there to get extra depth. Yeah, you can see those webs are gone. Want to drop that in there real quick? Go ahead.
A member of the county's bridge team can be heard whistling in amazement as a video camera inserted into the bridge's interior displays cracks in subsurface beams. This discovery prompted immediate closures and inspections by the county. Litigations have been ongoing since problems were detected, and all parties involved have exchanged legal blows. This includes Multnomah County, Conway Construction, who installed the panels, and the manufacturers of the panels themselves, Zelcomp and Strongwell Corporation. The problems have been blamed on everything from faulty materials to incompetent construction to cost-cutting and the prioritizing of deadlines. As of this report, the county was unable to comment due to ongoing litigation, and all other parties directed inquiries to their attorneys. For now, taxpayers will shell out the estimated $2 million to cover the repairs until the lawsuits are decided. And in the meantime, commuters who regularly use the Morrison Bridge will have to find alternative routes. The current eastbound closures will be followed by westbound closures, each lasting 3 weeks to allow for inspections. And that doesn't include any potential closures in the future to finish the repairs. For KBOO News, I'm Nico Kwiatkowski.
Today, the Portland City Council accepted the recommendations of the African American Leadership Council on how to spend $20 million for affordable housing in North and Northeast Portland. Most of those who testified at today's council meeting repeated the point that $20 million is not enough to address the decades of displacement and gentrification of Portland's African American community. Katrina Holland with the NAACP was one of those who testified.
I don't know if everybody remembers the process, but we are on a national stage with just this little bit of money. Due to its symbolism and how it came about, two, we cannot wait for and rely on the private sector to raise wages enough to support some of the changes that have happened in North and Northeast Portland, and we cannot wait on the rental market to crash to make units affordable again. I mean, lack of demand may bring prices down, but again, the stakes in damage control in such conditions are way too high. Not only that, but people are paying these astronomically high rents, so there's really no reason to change them. And if these changes were to happen, I don't think none of these phenomena are going to happen anytime soon. However, the demand is now. We can't wait because people like myself, millennials attempting to build our socioeconomic foundations, are staring at unjust scales. I mean, we have to make decisions between healthcare, food, paying rent or the mortgage, building a family, career choices, caring for our loved ones as they age, student loans, and more. And I really think that's unfair, despite doing all that we were raised to do. Just go to school and have lofty career aspirations. So I support the plan that comes before you today. Like Andrew said, I don't think it's a complete fix, but I think it's a step in the right direction. So as you hear this proposal, I ask that you keep in mind this fork in the road that I've attempted to bring to the forefront of this discussion. We can continue business as usual, investing in things we've done previously, increasing our risk of stifling advancement towards true socioeconomic equity and justice, or we can stare our history in the face and say no more. And I think we have that opportunity. We can be example to the state and to the nation because of where we are with this process. And we can show them what equitable and impactful economic development looks like. So I challenge you to not look at this proposal as not just another series of line items in a budget, but as the catalyst to a driving force that is going to promote equitable advancement for all Portland citizens, especially the historically disadvantaged.
Kat Gojenauer also testified at today's city council hearing. She represents the Portland African American Leadership Forum.
In 1993, we had created the Albina Community Plan in conjunction with the city, and it was a proactive, comprehensive, community-led, anti-displacement, anti-gentrification planning document, which promised to stem the impact of hyperinvestment in the interstate corridor and renewal areas to bring the benefit to the residents, not just redeveloped sticks and bricks. An area that was segregated, redlined, disinvested in, and whose people's equity was stripped through the housing crisis. However, over the past 15 years, our people have not been able to take advantage of the renewed investment. Therefore, we think a health wealth strategy is needed. So by investing in the most vulnerable and excluded, we can achieve multiple returns on investment, including both regional economic prosperity and well-being. As Katrina outlined, the returns on investment are exponential. Therefore, we need to aggressively tackle the root causes, which concentrates poverty and which at this point is moving our community members out to underdeveloped parts of the city and concentrating poverty again. To this end, we believe a right to return policy to areas of high opportunity makes a lot of sense. We believe the $20 million allocated by the city marks a sea change in budget and policy practices and bodes well for future policy intervention system disparate impact and different treatment of that our community has faced and continues to face. At this point, we do need, as Dr. Bethel said, explicit assurance and commitment that this $20 million will be the seed that catalyzes strategic systemic change to close the gap between those who are thriving and those in need, and it's not just a one-off. We need to leverage this investment many times over to address the long-term housing stability, homeownership, community development, and placemaking for our community members.
That was Kat Gojenauer with the Portland African American Leadership Forum speaking at today's city council meeting in Portland. Commissioner Nick Fish asked one of the city officials involved in the development of the plan for the $20 million about the right of return for former residents of North and Northeast Portland.
The second question I want to ask you has to do with the right of return. The Federal Fair Housing Act, which for people that follow that law closely, is now the Supreme Court has taken a case and is poised apparently to gut it and to say that disparate impact cases would no longer be actionable, which would be just in the pantheon of civil rights decisions, one of the all-time worst, but there's some rumors to that effect. The fair housing laws say that you have to take race out of the equation when you're deciding to rent to someone. So in an instance like this, where disproportionately race is at the heart of a displacement story, how does a right of return work where race can't be explicitly a part of the criteria for exercising that right?
Right. So we've spent, thanks to the city attorney's office, and I think Linda Law has been working with us on this. She may be here as well. So what we've learned, you're right, we cannot call out any protected class, but we can call out a geography. This is a geography that has historically been the heart of our African-American community, and so folks who lived in that geography are not exclusively African-American, but certainly have historically been in large numbers. But it's about the geography. And that's why we can't, and there's certainly nuances in how it gets rolled out that we have to be careful with and thoughtful about. But if it's about the geography that and not a protected class, and at least for the moment, doesn't disparately impact a protected class, which this would not as long as the geography is this geography, then we're okay.
That was testimony from today's city council meeting in Portland. The council approved the plan to spend $20 million on affordable housing in North and Northeast Portland.
The owners of a Lake Oswego housing complex will pay $475,000 to settle claims that they did not make reasonable accommodation for a disabled resident. The resident, Robin Buckley, filed suit in 2012 against One Jefferson Apartments. It alleged that Buckley's husband requested a parking spot near to the apartment because of a medical condition which impaired his ability to walk. In 2012, he fell in the parking lot, sustaining what would turn out to be fatal injuries. Signs designating the parking spot had been placed at the apartment the day before he died. Oregon law requires landlords to make accommodations to disabled tenants. A Bureau of Labor and Industries investigation found California-based Prometheus Real Estate engaged in discrimination. Prometheus claims to be the largest owner of multifamily housing in the San Francisco Bay Area. The settlement was announced by State Labor Commissioner Brad Avakian and Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum in a joint statement.
The Portland Development Council has selected four projects for the Lentz Town Center Urban Renewal Area meant to revitalize the neighborhood that residents have long accused the city of neglecting. Four mixed-use projects were chosen from a list of nine, which include two multi-building housing developments, retail and office space, and an Asian health center, which will include 60 units of senior housing, a multi-generational clinic, and Chinese immersion preschool. The developments will be built on PDC-owned land. The PDC owns two additional parcels in Lentz, but no decisions have been made regarding this. The decision to move forward means that developer involved with the projects may move forward with the negotiations with the PDC over project timelines in the purchase of the properties. The announcement of the four projects was made at the Lentz Neighborhood Association last night.
The Portland Police Bureau has released its latest report on officer discipline. The report covers 14 cases brought before the Police Review Board between June 15th of last year and December 25th. Its findings include the case of an officer fired for testing positive for steroids, the first officer terminated since the Bureau began random drug tests in 2012. Other misconduct cases involve two incidents of inappropriate touching and another where a supervising officer made a series of graphic and derogatory statements about women over a period of months. Both officers accused of inappropriate touching resigned, while the officer who made the statements regarding women was suspended without pay for 40 hours. Portland officer Kent Scott was suspended 1 week without pay for driving drunk while off duty, while Officer James Escobar was fired for taking the license plates and vehicle identification number off his personal car after repeatedly being given parking tickets. Two officers were suspended without pay for 20 hours after confronting and punching a man accused of making a gesture as if he were pointing an imaginary gun at them. The names of the officers cited are unknown unless previously reported, as the report redacted the officers' names and gender pronouns to conceal the identity of those involved. The full report can be found at the City of Portland's website.
A report in the Chronicle of Higher Education has named University of Oregon Professor Bill Harbaugh as the professor the school says is in possession with 22,000 pages of confidential documents. News of the documents released came last week in an email from the school to faculty and staff. Two university staff were also given suspensions related to the release of the documents. The university maintains that the release of the documents was unlawful and had set a deadline for Harbaugh to return the documents, which has since passed. The documents are said to contain correspondence with four previous university presidents, according to the University of Oregon. Harbaugh is an economics professor who authors the popular U of O Matters blog. He is a frequent critic of the university and won an Oregon Society of Professional Journalists award in 2009 for publishing state public record request guidelines that the state had previously only made available through purchase. Harbaugh has so far declined to speak with media on the matter of the university documents. On U of O Matters, he directs media requests to University Director of Public Affairs, Tobin Klinger. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for news from the BOO, followed by the Underground at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be partly cloudy but dry, with a high of 51 and a low of 40 degrees. Today in history, in 1909, United States soldiers left Cuba after the Spanish-American War with the exception of a naval base at Guantanamo Bay. In 1958, the Lego Company patented its design for toy building bricks. And in 1986, the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded after liftoff at Cape Canaveral, Florida, killing the 7 astronauts on board. The quote of the day is from José Martí, the 19th century Cuban political theorist, poet, and revolutionary who was born this day in 1853. Like bones to the human body, the axle to the wheel, the wing to the bird, and the air to the wing, so is liberty the essence of life. Whatever is done, without it is imperfect. It's 5:22, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Jamie is PO'd. He's fed up with all this populistic attitude that's sweeping the country, and he's not going to take it anymore. Jamie Dimon recently bleated to reporters that, quote, banks are under assault. Well, not most banks, but J.P. Morgan Chase, America's largest Wall Street empire, which Jamie heads. Government regulators, he snarls, are pandering to grassroots populist anger at Wall Street excesses by squeezing the life out of his banking casino. But wait, didn't J.P. Morgan score a $22 billion profit last year, the highest in its history? And didn't those big, bad, oppressive government regulators provide a $25 billion taxpayer bailout in 2008 to save Jamie's conglomerate from its own reckless excesses? And isn't this Wall Street popinjay raking in some $20 million in personal pay to suffer the indignity of this so-called assault on his bank? Yes, yes, and yes. Still, Jamie says that regulators are piling on J.P. Morgan Chase. In the old days, he whined, you dealt with one regulator when you had an issue. Now it's five or six. You should all ask the question about how American that is, the $20 million a year man lectured to reporters, how fair that is. Well, golly, one reason Chase has half a dozen regulators on his case is because it doesn't have, quote, an issue of illegality, but beaucoup illegalities, including deceiving its own investors, cheating more than 2 million of its credit card customers, gaming the rules to overcharge electricity users in California and the Midwest, overcharging active duty military families on their mortgages, illegally foreclosing on troubled homeowners, and, well, so much more. This is Jim Hightower saying, so Jamie, ask yourself, how fair is all of the above? Then you should shut up and be grateful you're not in jail.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A Florida woman who was imprisoned for firing what she deemed a warning shot at her abusive husband in 2010 has been released from prison. Marissa Alexander gained national recognition after being sentenced to a 20-year mandatory sentence in 2012 in a case where she unsuccessfully attempted to use the state's Stand Your Ground self-defense law. The case proceeded against the backdrop of George Zimmerman's trial for the murder of unarmed African-American teenager Trayvon Martin. Police in that case had cited the law as their rationale for not initially bringing charges against Zimmerman. Alexander is African-American, and her supporters cited her case as a racist double standard. Alexander had her conviction overturned in 2013, but took a plea for a lesser sentence on three counts of aggravated assault last year. Today at a hearing, a judge gave her credit for time served, but placed her under house arrest for 2 years.
A police killing of a teenage girl in Denver has led to protests in the city and a renewed call on social media to curb police violence. The 17-year-old Jessica Hernandez was an out lesbian and a Latina. The LGBT and Latino communities in Denver have come together to protest this latest act of police violence. According to initial police statements, Jessica was behind the wheel of a stolen car when officers responded to a call about suspicious activity in an alley. Police claim the teenager struck an officer with the car, prompting the officers to open fire, ultimately killing Hernandez. An autopsy report ruled the cause of death to be multiple gunshot wounds and declared the death to be a homicide. Four other teenagers who were in the car were taken into custody at the time. The teens claim that the officers dragged Jessica's body from the car and proceeded to search and handcuff her limp body. Family and friends of the deceased have demanded access to video that purportedly shows the teen being searched after being shot. Denver Police Department Chief Robert White told reporters that he thinks the facts will show that hopefully the officers' reactions were correct. Police officials have since announced that none of the teens in the car had weapons.
The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration is creating a widespread highway license plate camera program to monitor millions of unknowing citizens, according to a report in the Christian Science Monitor. The agency says this system will be to catch smugglers and other criminals. But civil liberties advocates worry that this highway monitoring system indicates an extension of federal efforts to monitor the general public's daily activities in violating of the Fourth Amendment.
The Koch brothers and their political network of right-wing billionaires have announced they will spend nearly $1 billion to impact the results of the 2016 presidential election campaign. These decisions were announced at the annual winter meeting of the Freedom Partners Chamber of Commerce in Palm Springs, California. That meeting was also attended by four of the GOP presidential hopefuls and six newly elected Republican senators.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
All right, we're not getting that audio we were looking for.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The American Postal Workers Union is on a crusade to both preserve postal services and to save good middle-class jobs in the process. APWU President Mark Demenstein says the campaign for postal banking would help the Postal Service while providing affordable basic banking services for low-income people who now depend on predatory check cashing and payday lending services that can take as much as 10% of their annual income.
Postal banking campaign should also be seen in the context of the social problem that's out there. The United States Postal Service did a report a year ago ago. It talked about 68 million adults not having access to the basic banking system, and therefore are often forced into the what they call the alternative financial services, what we would call legal loan sharking of payday loans, check cashing places, and so on.
Demenstein says that with a new Congress, Postal Service issues remain the same, so the APWU will have to wait and see what, if anything, the new Congress is willing to do to end the requirement that roughly $5 billion a year be paid to prepay postal worker retiree health care.
The Postal Service needs relief from a congressionally manufactured financial crisis. We need to fend off any attacks on six-day delivery, on slowing down the mail, on closing processing plants. And we need legislation that will help the Post Office innovate, like providing these kind of enhanced and deeper services.
Demenstein says 200,000 postal jobs have been lost over the past 10 years. The Illinois AFL-CIO says billionaire Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner is going after workers on all fronts. As a candidate, he once proposed cutting the minimum wage. Now he's pushing anti-union defunding measures and attacking unemployment insurance and workers' compensation, as well as prevailing wage and project labor agreements that benefit workers and taxpayers. The AFL-CIO says Rauner is trying to implement a middle-class eradication agenda. Illinois AFL-CIO President Michael T. Kerrigan says Rauner's attacks on workers in the middle class will be vigorously opposed by labor and community allies in Illinois. Teamsters Allegiant Air pilots have authorized a strike if necessary after 2 years of fruitless efforts to bargain a contract. The Teamsters say Allegiant isn't bargaining in good faith. Captain Greg Underseer is a Teamsters Allegiant pilot. He says pilot salaries and working conditions are below industry par, and even the mechanical safety of the aircraft is an issue at Allegiant.
Some of my pilots are on the road for as long as 19 months with little chance to get home in between their trips. The draconian work rules of the company's penchant for changing them to suit its needs, regardless of the impact of employees, has led to a very toxic relationship with the pilots. In my 25 years of experience as an airline pilot, I have not seen this kind of treatment of a group professional pilot.
This newscast made possible in part through support from the United Mine Workers of America and from the United Steelworkers. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Environmental Protection Agency is being sued for failing to keep factory farm air pollution under control. A coalition of environmental and animal rights activists has filed two lawsuits against the EPA. The coalition says that the 20,000 factory farms in the U.S. are triggering human health problems like asthma and heart attacks. Health issues for animals include dead zones in waterways and intensified effects of climate change. The EPA lawsuit reports that these industrial farms host billions of agricultural livestock and that the animals release noxious air pollutants that aren't being regulated. Both EPA lawsuits demand that the agency take action on two proposed lawmaking petitions. The petitions were filed in 2009 and 2011 to call on the EPA to regulate factory farm air pollution with the agency's power under the Federal Clean Air Act. The EPA lawsuit demand a decision on the 2009 and 2011 petitions within 90 days.
A gas pipeline burst on Monday in West Virginia, about an hour southeast of Pittsburgh. A number of residents have said they saw what appeared to be a large fireball burning in the sky. Brooke County Sheriff Chuck Jackson said no injuries have been reported and no structural damage has occurred, but several area roads have been closed because of burning gas. There's no word yet on what caused the explosion, which took place in a pipeline owned by Enterprise Products LP. The company is based in Texas and oversees 50,000 miles of pipelines throughout the U.S. Snowy weather helped prevent the spread of the fire caused by the blast. Enterprise Products LP said they are working with the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration to determine the cause of the explosion. The company said in a statement that they did not notice a pressure drop earlier in the day prior to the explosion. This is the fourth major pipeline incident that's occurred this month. In Montana 2 weeks ago, a 50,000-gallon oil residue spill resulted in cancer-causing chemicals leaking into residents' drinking water.
On Monday, former CIA official Jeffrey Sterling was convicted of espionage for leaking information to a New York Times reporter. While the government portrayed Sterling as a spy, his supporters say that he acted as a whistleblower, and his conviction continues a dangerous precedent of the Obama administration's war on leaks. Ashley Westerman of Free Speech Radio News has more.
A Virginia jury convicted Jeffrey Sterling on all 9 felony charges against him in a case related to the leaking of classified information about a botched CIA program. 7 of the charges were brought under the Espionage Act of 1917. Sterling was accused of being the confidential source Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times journalist James Risen risked prison to protect. Risen's book, State of War, details a secret spy program called Operation Merlin that aimed to thwart Iran's nuclear program, the same program Sterling had reported concerns about years earlier to the Senate Intelligence Committee.
This case represents a new low in terms of both whistleblower protection and press freedom.
That's Government Accountability Project National Security and Human Rights Director Jesselyn Radacht reacting to Sterling's conviction. She says there was no direct evidence that Sterling ever discussed the Iranian nuclear program with Risen, and that the prosecution relied on circumstantial evidence. The prosecution argued Sterling, who is one of the CIA's very few African-American agents, was a disgruntled employee who leaked classified information in order to get back at the agency after it opted not to pursue his complaints of on-the-job discrimination.
They took circumstantial evidence, and even though there was plenty of reasonable doubt that permeated this case, they still convicted Sterling.
Radacht says the Obama administration's position on whistleblowers is hypocritical in that senior government officials are able to leak with impunity information that furthers an official line. U.S. Director of Reporters Without Borders, Delphine Algand, says the general climate for press freedom in the U.S. is very concerning. Since President Obama took office, there have been 8 prosecutions of alleged whistleblowers, more than under all previous administrations combined. Algon says Sterling's conviction is a continuation of that war.
And clearly we see this war against whistleblowers as a way to restrict the facts to the only official version. Because in a country where almost all information is considered secret or classified, if you don't have leaks, you cannot have real investigative journalists.
Algon says the Sterling verdict also calls attention to the need for a federal shield, allowing journalists to better protect their sources without having to face the threat of criminal charges. While congressional lawmakers have introduced such legislation many times, none has passed, and state shield laws vary widely. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder said in a statement Monday that Sterling's case had a, quote, just and appropriate outcome, end quote. Sterling could face years in prison and should be sentenced in April. It's unclear if he will appeal. Ashley Westerman, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
In Israel, Hezbollah militants in Lebanon fired anti-tank missiles at a military convoy near the border between the two countries and Syria, killing 2 Israeli soldiers and 1 United Nations peacekeeper from Spain. 7 other Israeli soldiers were injured in the attack. The attack marks the largest escalation of the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon since the 2006 war, which left over 1,000 Lebanese civilians dead. The hostility comes amidst the backdrop of border escalations between Lebanon and Syria, with missile firing being traded over the border of the two countries yesterday. Hezbollah is fighting in Syria's civil war in support of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave a brief statement regarding the attack, saying the attackers would pay the full price. Israel's Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman called for a forceful and disproportionate response. Hezbollah, in a statement claiming the attack, said it was in retaliation for an Israeli air attack that killed a senior commander in Syria 10 days ago. The United Nations also commented on the incident, urging maximum restraint by all parties.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, January 28th, 2015. Israeli army bomb injures a Palestinian teenager in the Jordan Valley, and settlers try to kidnap a boy from East Jerusalem. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian miner was injured Wednesday after an explosive device left behind by Israeli army went off in Ain al-Hilwa area of the Jordan Valley, according to local sources. 15-year-old Ali Ilayan sustained injuries from the shrapnel of a remnant Israeli bomb. He was transferred to hospital for treatment. According to local sources, the Israeli army holds periodic military exercises in the Jordan Valley involving the use of warplanes and live ammunition, which causes a high risk on the local families living there. Elsewhere, an Israeli settler Wednesday morning assaulted a Palestinian teenager from At-Turi neighborhood near Silwan in occupied East Jerusalem while the boy was walking to school. Jamil Ghith told local news agencies that the settler attempted to kidnap his 14-year-old son Ibrahim but managed to flee the scene. Mr. Ghith explained that a group of settlers from one of the illegal outposts in At-Turi stopped their car while one stepped out and brutally attacked Ibrahim. The settler then tried to drag the boy forcibly into the car, but the boy started to scream for help and managed to run away. Locals called Israeli police, who arrived, and instead of looking for the attackers, they began assaulting Palestinian residents who were at the site, including family members of the boy. The victim was taken to the West Jerusalem's Shaar Tzedek Medical Center for treatment, while his father filed a complaint at an Israeli police station. In other news, two Israeli soldiers have been killed following an exchange of fire between the Shuhada al-Quneitra Hezbollah group in Syria and Israeli forces in Shib'a village on the southern Lebanon borders occupied Golan Heights. A Spanish United Nations interim force in Lebanon, UNIFIL soldier, was killed in South Lebanon during an Israeli attack in the same region earlier on Wednesday. In Gaza, Israeli troops stationed across the borders with the Gaza Strip opened fire Wednesday morning at Palestinian fields east of Khan Yunis. Local sources said that the Israeli soldiers fired machine guns at agricultural lands in the outskirts of Al-Fukhari village. No injuries or casualties were reported. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, January 28, 2015 News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Nico Kwiatkowski and Joanna Peterson. The producer is Mike Klepfer. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jinka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Nico Kwiatkowski.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow on KABU. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Joanne Hardesty hosts Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. At 9, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on Between the Covers, host David Nyman speaks with Miranda July about her debut novel, The First Bad Man. Thanks, KABU members, for your generous support. If you're not a KABU member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned. Coming up next, news from the Boo.
Time for KABU News from the Boo with
Mike
and
Monica Beamer.
Good evening. It's that time again. News from the Boo, our weekly program, Wednesdays at 5:45. This is a chance for us to hear from folks inside of KABU about happenings inside of and around KABU. Tonight, we are with station co-manager Monica Beamer. Good evening.
Hello.
So all you listeners out there, the phone lines will be open. If you'd like to call in with a question or a comment, go ahead and dial up 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. So Monica, what's happening at KABU?
Lots and lots and lots, as always,
oh,
happening. So we've talked about this a little bit in News from the Boo, but we're in the process of hiring a development director, and we're really excited about that. And that's thanks to a grant from the Meyer Memorial Trust. And let's see, we have an event this Saturday for volunteers. And I believe it's 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., not 7 a.m. 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Mother Foucault Bookstore, 523 Southeast Morrison. And the staff are going to bake cookies. I did a cookie challenge at the staff meeting this week. And doing all of the setup and cleanup to thank our amazing volunteers. And if you want to become a volunteer, then come to the next volunteer training, which is Tuesday, February 17th from 6 to 8 p.m. We had 40 people here this past Saturday for the most recent volunteer training. Yeah. And so for more information, contact, of course, Ani Haynes at volunteer at KBO,